Welcome to another episode of Out of the Blank Podcast. Sam, it is a pleasure to have you on the show. I'm really excited to talk with you today. Do you mind introducing yourself to everyone out there listening?
Robbie, first of all, I want to thank you very much for asking me to be on your show. It's really an honor. I know you've got a good following out there, and I'm going to try to make this as informative and as interesting as I possibly can. For your listeners, my name is Sam Peroni. I live in Arkansas, and I am a former federal prosecuting attorney, an assistant United States attorney for the Eastern District of Arkansas, and then criminal defense attorney. And until my retirement in 2008, I prosecuted federal criminal cases. And then I defended federal criminal cases for a total of about 40 years. And of course, doing that, I learned how to investigate criminal cases, all kinds of criminal cases. That's important to the matter of the death of Natalie Wood, because up to this point in time, and this is no criticism now, but up to this point in time, everyone that's written about her death has not been an experienced criminal investigator. As a matter of fact, they have zero experience. Now, that's not to say that someone who doesn't have criminal law experience can't go out and look for evidence and find evidence, because, you know, it's happened in cases before. But this particular case, it's important that the person have criminal law experience that's writing about it, because in the past, the investigators, the criminal investigators with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, theoretically, were looking for a smoking gun, as well as the book authors that wrote before me. What they wanted was, they wanted a witness, like an eyewitness, or somebody who could say, well, we saw Robert Wagner push Natalie Wood off the boat. Now, it didn't happen, of course, because there were four people on this boat back in the Thanksgiving weekend of 1981. One was Christopher Walken, the famous actor that you know. He was a young man back then and just won an Academy Award for The Deer Hunter. And then the next person was the boat captain. His name is Dennis DeVern, and he had been the boat captain on the Splendor, the Wagner's yacht, for probably about maybe 7 or 8 years by the time Natalie's death occurred. And then there, of course, there was Robert Wagner, Natalie Wood's husband. It really is Robert Wagner Jr. His daddy was also Robert Wagner. So there were four people on the boat. But of course, one of them was found dead. And so we now have three people on this boat. So everybody's looking for a smoking gun. Well, Walken has claimed publicly for the last 45 years that he was, quote, asleep when this happened. So basically what he did was he took himself out of the picture with the perfect alibi. I was asleep all night long. Now, I'll tell you later, I found a lot of evidence to contradict that and to show that that was untrue. And we can talk about that if you'd like. But we've got him now out of the picture as far as the smoking gun, because he was asleep. Then we have the boat captain. And the boat captain, when Natalie disappeared, or became a missing person, he was clear at the top up in the captain's nest way at the top in some of these yachts. The captain can actually steer and guide the boat. And it was a little area that had the throttle and steering wheel and such. And it was surrounded by Ensign glass. And I don't know if you know what Ensign glass is, but it's a clear plastic. I mean, you can see through it, but it's difficult to see through it, if you understand what I'm saying. So he was up there now. It's at night, by the way. So there's no clouds, there's no moon, there's no stars. And he's up there, and he has said all along, well, I could hear him, but I really couldn't see him that well. And so he's out of the picture. And then Robert Wagner, who has given a couple false statements to the detectives back in 1981, he has kept his mouth shut for his entire life when it comes to the actual facts of what happened that night. You know, he's 93 or 94 years old right now, and maybe not even in a condition to be able to remember anything, but he's out of the picture. So Natalie's gone, and the witnesses that were on the boat are basically out of the picture as far as a smoking gun is concerned. So when I decided to investigate Natalie Wood's case, I knew that it was a circumstantial evidence case. It's always been a circumstantial evidence case. But circumstantial evidence is used in courtrooms every day in this country. Thousands and thousands of cases, juries find and convict people based on circumstantial evidence. And the first thing you do when you investigate a murder case is you look for motive evidence. You develop a timeline, and then you look for motive evidence, and you start eliminating people as potential suspects, or including them, depending upon the timeline and their relative motives, all right? Well, up until the time I started investigating this case, no one, and when I say no one, I'm talking no one, book authors or investigators, looked for any motive evidence. They didn't look for it anywhere. And so the first thing I did was I started looking for motive evidence. And in a minute or two, we'll discuss some of the evidence that I found that no one's ever written about. No one. Not any of the book authors up to this point in time. Not the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. No one. Not the coroner's office. Not a soul. So let's go back to Natalie Wood for a moment, because I know you have a lot of listeners that maybe have never even heard her name. They don't even know who Natalie Wood was. Well, Natalie Wood was born in 1938, July the 20th. And for those people who like trivia, another significant July the 20th event was when the United States landed a man on the moon. It happened on July the 20th. Well, anyway, back to Natalie. 1938. Well, her mother was a very strange lady. She was into mythical kind of things and kind of far out, you know, ideas about life and things like that. And it was reported, and she said that she went to a fortune teller who told her that she was going to have a daughter who was going to become a famous actress. Well, that prompted her mother to be an ambitious, passionate persistent person in getting Natalie into the movies. So Natalie's first entrance into the movies was when she was 4 years old. It was 1942. And her mother managed to get her a small part, just a small little part in a movie that was being filmed where they lived in Santa Rosa, California. That's close to San Francisco for people who don't know. And what she did in this movie, the significance of what Natalie, a four-year-old now, did in this movie was she was to drop her ice cream cone and then cry, okay? So in essence, little Natalie Wood, four-year-old, was supposed to cry on cue. Now, first of all, I've never been an actor, so I wouldn't know this, but I would suspect that crying on cue is not an easy thing to do. But little Natalie dropped her ice cream cone and cried on cue just like that. I mean, I don't even think they even had but one take. Well, the movie director was so impressed with this little girl that he started visiting with her mother about getting her into other movies. And the next thing you know, her mother packs up the whole family and they move to Los Angeles, California, down to Hollywood, where they could be close to the action. And Natalie starts getting parts in movies. And a director, I can't remember his name, but at some point a director described Natalie as this. He called her One Take Natalie. And that was because she knew her lines so well. And she was so good at her craft that they would do scenes and it would be one take with Natalie. And people saw this. And so the next thing you know, when they had little children in movies, Natalie Wood is appearing with the biggest stars in the business, Jimmy Stewart, Betty Davis, Orson Welles, a whole lot of people, and your folks might not know who those people are either, but if they look them up, they'll see how famous they were. And these people were impressed with this little girl. So she got into a lot of movies from 1942 up to 1946. And in 1946, she actually got an award from a Box Office magazine, I think it was called, as the best new talent in the child talent in the business. And this was 1946, and Natalie was 8 years old. She appeared in 13 movies between 1946 and 1955. And in 1955, she was 17 years old. And at 17 years old, through persistence, as she was like her mother in that regard, she got a part in a movie called Rebel Without a Cause with the famous, iconic James Dean, who, by the way, only made three movies, and he's, you know, still, everybody knows who James Dean is, like Marilyn Monroe. But she made this movie with James Dean, and she got a nomination for Best Supporting Actress, an Academy Award nomination, at 17 years old in that movie. She didn't win, but she got a nomination, and everybody saw what kind of actress she was. I think it was Orson Welles said this about her: Natalie Wood didn't act from a script. Natalie Wood acted from the heart. And that was the key to Natalie Wood's success. Number one, she must have been a brilliant child. because when she couldn't read, her mother would read her the scripts, and Natalie would memorize the lines and things from what her mother told her. She must have been a brilliant lady, but she also acted from the heart. I mean, when she did a part, she became the person in that part. And if you watch any of Natalie's movies, you see that. She was one of those actresses where if she was in a movie, even if it was a bad movie, she could raise the quality of the movie on her own. And, you know, there are people in the business that can do that now too, right? That you can just call off the top of your head. If they're in a movie, even if it's a terrible movie, somehow or other at the end of the movie, you go, well, that wasn't real great, but it wasn't real bad either. Yeah. And so she became very much sought after. And I just made some notes here, but between 1955 with Rebel Without a Cause and 1961, 6 years, she had five movies that have been selected for the Library of Congress as being historically significant movies. So I tell your listeners all this so they'll understand what a big star she was in 1981. Natalie was known all over the world. I mean, before the internet, it didn't matter. People still knew Natalie Wood. She got awards in Europe. She got awards in Britain for things that she did in the United States. And so she was a superstar. Yes, sir.
I might be jumping the shark on this one, but because with that type of celebrity, you probably have a lot more eyes looking into your personal life, your romantic relationships, and really anything you do throughout whatever you do, that there becomes so many theories surrounding her death because of the fact that people felt like they knew her more personally than maybe they actually did. You know, like if you talk about Robert Wagner, I don't know his involvement in it. I mean, I've heard people mention they think that he was involved. But if you're a fan of Natalie Wood and she's with this person that you might not like, you're going to tend to suspect it's him. Like I said, might be jumping the shark, but just my thoughts.
Yes. It's not jumping ahead, but let me answer your point this way. You are exactly right, but people have to keep something in mind when they start thinking about Natalie Wood's life and Natalie Wood's death. This was before the internet. This was before you could punch up Natalie Wood and find out everything you wanted to about her. So people had to get their information out of celebrity magazines and what the press did, what the news did, and more importantly, what they did in their movies. That's the big difference about then and today. And also, if you go back to when Natalie was a big star, that was the golden age of Hollywood. That people revered. They still do somewhat, but not as much because of the internet. We find out about people very quickly when they do something awful. We find out about it very quickly now. But back then, see, they were revered and they were protected. They were protected by the authorities. They were protected by the movie studios. The movie studios had their hired on-staff fixers, people that fixed problems. When one of their stars who was on contract, and that's another thing, back then, the movie stars were on contract to the movie studios. They signed a contract and they could not do a movie unless the movie studio said they could do a movie. If another movie studio wanted to use the actor or actress, they had to have the permission of the studio they had the contract with, and there had to be some money exchange hands. I mean, they were property, for lack of a better way to put it. So because they were valuable property, they were protected by the industry, and they were protected by people who had money in the industry or were anticipating money from the industry, including organized crime. Organized crime got involved with the entertainment business back in the 30s when they started helping singers and other entertainers.
Hold on. You gotta be honest about it. Johnny Rosselli did a good job in some of those movies.
That's right. He did. Well, it was true. Back at the time, let's take Frank Sinatra for example. Back at the time Frank Sinatra first started, all the places, the venues where singers first started singing and doing performances and things, all the venues in New York and places like that were all owned by the mob. And so if you wanted to sing in one of those venues, you had to be connected with one of the mobsters. And when you were connected with one of the mobsters, once they helped you do something, then that was it. They owned you. Okay. Well, Frank Sinatra, I mean, it's not even disputed that Frank Sinatra got his start through the influence of a mobster called Willie Moretti. And Willie was the godfather out in New Jersey. And he took Frank Sinatra under his wing. So back to Hollywood, all right? We still had the mob heavily involved in Hollywood back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even up into the 80s. For all I know, they still may be involved in Hollywood. I don't know. I haven't investigated that. But I tell everybody this so that they'll understand clearly what kind of movie star Natalie Wood was, and also how they protected people who were in the business. So, for example, when Natalie Wood died, the thrust was not about protecting Natalie Wood's image or anything of that nature. The thrust was protecting Robert Wagner, because Robert Wagner was married to Natalie Wood, and Robert Wagner was still in the industry. As a matter of fact, he had a hit TV show going on called Heart to Heart, and nobody wanted to mess that up, to put it bluntly.
Would that explain some of maybe the differences of stories that came out when Natalie died, either suppression of information? It doesn't have to be necessarily nefarious, but if you look at the opposite of the blacklist and you're protecting your business asset in Hollywood, like Robert Wagner, then you would understand more about the suppression and how it's taken some time for information to leak out, or why this wasn't reported on.
Absolutely. Without any doubt, that's exactly the explanation for the different stories and the kind of, perplexing ways that the authorities provided evidence to the public, which gets me up to the next point. That is, what was the official conclusion in Natalie Wood's death? Okay, Natalie Wood passed away on the high seas. And what that means is that there was jurisdiction at Catalina Island, which was part of Los Angeles County. All right. So the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department had jurisdiction over Natalie's death. The Coast Guard, the Federal Coast Guard, had jurisdiction over Natalie's death. And the Los Angeles County Coroner was responsible under the law for performing an autopsy on anyone who died of drowning. That's what the law said. Okay. So you had these three official agencies that were supposed to be involved. Well, first of all, if you read my book, which, by the way, you can get a hardback on Amazon or a Barnes & Noble and a paperback on my website, NatalieWoodBrainstorm.com. If you read my book, you will find out that I uncovered evidence that the Coast Guard was denied investigative access into Natalie Wood's death. The Coast Guard, there are cases where the Coast Guard is always involved with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department when somebody drowns on the water around Los Angeles and places like that. Well, they were denied access to her, to what happened out there. And I have evidence of it that you can read about in my book. So now the Coast Guard's out of the picture. The Coast Guard isn't making any pronouncements and they're not doing any investigative work. So now, and then you might say to yourself, well, how in the world did the Coast Guard get prohibited or blocked from conducting an investigation? They were blocked because the sheriff at the time, Peter Pitches, had been the sheriff for like 30 years, and was probably one of the most powerful guys in Los Angeles County, next to the mobsters. And whatever Sheriff Pitches wanted, Sheriff Pitches got when it came to investigation. So we have now the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and the coroner's office. Well, literally within hours, if you read my book, you'll see, within hours, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department was saying it was an accident. Matter of fact, the lead detective said it was nothing but a, quote, big time celebrity drowning, close quote. So the sheriff's office declares it to be an accident without even really conducting an investigation. And then the coroner's office, it was headed by a fellow by the name of Thomas Noguchi, who was referred to as the coroner to the stars.
He was the RFK coroner.
Marilyn Monroe, JFK.
RFK. He was RFK's coroner. He did the most thorough autopsy, 36-page report.
I said JFK. Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm old. And so I get confused sometimes, but RFK and a lot of other celebrity deaths that occurred in Hollywood around that time, he did the autopsies. Well, he got the nicknames Coroner to the Stars because of that. And he was, listen, he had become a big shot in the autopsy world, all right, and was known internationally himself. Well, they performed the autopsy, and we can get into the autopsy if you'd like right now, but they performed the autopsy, and there were three forensic pathologists that were involved in the autopsy of Natalie Wood. Three, not one. And they were involved for various reasons. But the ultimate conclusion after their autopsy within, let's see, about 36 hours was that it was an accident. she slipped and fell overboard and floated away and drowned, and we're sorry, but that's the end of it. All right. Now, that conclusion is at odds with things that are actually in the autopsy report, but that was his conclusion. And so the official narrative in 1981, and then going into 1982, because all this happened on November the 29th, 1981, was that Natalie Wood's death was an accident. Even though there were bazillions of questions by the media and by members of the public, including myself, about how Natalie Wood actually died. But that was the official narrative at the time.
What were some of the differences that didn't match, I guess, the pathologist reports compared to what the autopsy said?
All right. The three pathologists involved were Dr. Noguchi. His chief assistant, Dr. Choi, C-H-O-I, and a doctor by the name of Kornblum. I believe that that's the way you pronounce his last name. All three of them were involved in Natalie Wood's autopsy. And let me tell you why. There's nothing written officially about why there were three, but I discovered why in my investigation. One of them was a chokehold expert. I believe that was Dr. Kornblum. And the other one, another one, was a strangulation expert, and that was Dr. Choi. Now, Dr. Noguchi held himself out as a bruise and wound expert. Well, Natalie Wood had, as identified by the autopsy material and autopsy report, in excess of 30 bruises on her body when she was found. Okay. So here's why the strangulation and chokehold experts were called in. They did an examination of Natalie's throat. And this is in the autopsy report, but it's not in there as to why, right? And when they did, they found no damage to the interior of his throat, her throat, like you would if she was strangled to death, all right? When somebody's strangled to death, when somebody puts their hands around your throat and they choke you hard enough to strangle you to death, there's going to be damage inside your throat, from just bruising to like broken things in your throat, all right? But here's why they examined her. They examined her because I discovered there was a scratch in the midline of Natalie's throat. Now, the reason why that's significant is if I am arguing with you and I grab you by the throat, if all I do is grab you by the throat, I'm not going to break anything inside your throat. I might not even choke you. But if I grab your throat, there is a likelihood that I will leave a thumbnail impression or a fingernail impression on your neck. Well, Natalie had one right in the midline of her throat. Now, the significance of this is, in the narrative portion of the autopsy report, it's not mentioned. Nobody mentions this scratch. The way I discovered it was I had my own forensic pathologist expert who was the former chief medical examiner for the state of Rhode Island and had participated in many autopsies of people who drowned. She was looking at the materials. We were looking at them together. And in the autopsy materials were two diagrams, the front, the interior, and the back, posterior diagrams, where when an autopsy is performed, what happens is the person that's doing the autopsy will call out to someone who will make notations on these diagrams, or if it's real important, the doctor actually makes his own notations on the diagrams. Now, based on my just visual examination of handwriting, I believe Dr. Choi made his own notations on the front and back of these front and back diagrams, because Dr. Choi actually performed the autopsy. Dr. Noguchi was just present and observed. Dr. Kornblum was there to look inside the throat only. But Dr. Choi was responsible for the autopsy. And don't ask me why. Dr. Noguchi didn't do it himself, but Dr. Choi did it. Well, in tiny little print, and you have to use a magnifying glass to be able to read it, in tiny little print, right in the middle of her throat, there was a line and then an arrow and to the word scratch. So I know that they thought when they first got the body in that Natalie Wood had been choked or strangled. And that's why they called in these folks. But the significance is they never mentioned this scratch on the throat. The second thing that was inconsistent with his accident stuff, back to the bruises. They described bruises, but they did not put a number in there as to how many bruises he had, but they described some of the bruises. And in the description, and again, on those diagrams, it was noted that there were some contusions. Contusions are different from bruises because contusions are deeper, all right? Well, one of the contusions that was noted, but it wasn't noted into the narrative as to the significance, was a bruise that was half as long as Natalie's forearm on her right arm underneath. That was a classic defensive wound. That is when people, when there's a fight and somebody's coming after them, the first thing they do is they put their hand up to block their face. And when they do, they get hit on the forearm, and that's where a bruise can be. Well, there was no notation in the narrative about the fact that it was consistent and classic defensive wound. Then in the narrative, instead of talking about the contusions and the deep bruises they had, which had to have been, according to my expert, caused by somebody, by them either being hit by somebody or something hitting them hard, okay? Not just a little bump, but hard. They described the bruises as superficial. That was the label they gave to the bruises, superficial, and suggested that they probably were sustained at the time of drowning. Well, Natalie was in the water. She wasn't near anything that could bruise her. She wasn't around debris. She wasn't around rocks. She was in the water at the far end of a cove. So there was nothing for Natalie Wood to bruise herself on. So my expert said the likelihood is most of those bruises were sustained before she went into the water. Then the last thing, and this is the most significant thing, which they also didn't mention in the narrative, but is included in one of the lab reports, was there were spots noted on Natalie's lungs that are classic bursting of blood vessels when someone is screaming and very, very loudly, very intense screaming. You can actually bust or break capillaries on your lungs. Well, the significance of that is that Dennis DeVern, the boat captain, has said, and his story is consistent with some of these circumstantial pieces of evidence, that there was a screaming, banging, cussing fight that occurred between Natalie and Robert Wagner in the master stateroom of the yacht shortly before Natalie, quote, disappeared, close quote. So it's that kind of consistency, inconsistency in the autopsy report that tells me that, in essence, there was a cover-up during the autopsy and an attempt to basically sidestep any evidence that would suggest that Natalie died from anything except for just falling off the boat and drowning. It's written just exactly that way, and things like that ignore. Then the same thing occurred with the official report of the sheriff's office. Me and the sheriff's office are the only folks that have copies of these things. And the reason why I have copies of them is I filed 4 lawsuits against the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and I was successful in every one of them. And I got documents that nobody else has, except for the sheriff's department in the official file. But there's a narrative report, and it's about 20 pages long. It's written by the chief detective. But once I completed my investigation, it was clear to me that the narrative report was manipulated, that important matters were omitted, and it was written basically to confirm their conclusion that it was a, quote, accident, close quote.
Can I ask about the changing statements of Robert Wagner and then also Christopher Walken?
You sure can. Here's what I discovered. When I obtained these official records, one of the things that I obtained was a copy of the original handwritten notes of the two investigators that were involved in Natalie Wood's death. One was a detective and had been a detective for many, many, many years, all right? So he was a homicide detective, and he knew, this is important, he knew how to investigate a homicide case. The other one was like what you would call today a crime scene investigator. He went with Detective Rashier, that's his last name. He went with him as a two-man team. Most of the time when criminal cases are investigated, there are two people on there. They interview people together. They might work separately on different pieces of evidence gathering stuff. But whenever there's an interview involved, there's always two of them. And of course, these guys both made notes on notepads. And by the way, they use the flip notepads, you know, the ones that flip over this way. Okay. They write, flip the page over, write, flip the page over. Well, there are, I'm just going to take a guess now. There's probably 125 pages of notes. But in order to read them, you have to get a magnifying glass and you have to painstakingly go over each word, which I did. And I would write above the word in red what it said. Well, when I did that, I discovered this. Let's talk about Christopher Walken for a moment. Because this guy, out of everyone, including Robert Wagner, this guy's the guy that makes my blood boil the most. The reason for this is when he gave a statement to the sheriff's department, the very first statement he gave, which was at 10 o'clock in the morning, the day that Natalie Wood's body was found, he told the sheriffs that there had been a beef between he and Robert Wagner before Natalie Wood ended up missing. And he also told them that when she turned up missing, that he helped look for her, which of course is totally inconsistent with him being asleep, unless he's a good sleepwalker and do things when he's asleep. But it's kind of totally inconsistent with him being asleep. Well, he gave this interview. And then, let's see, was it the next day or day after that? He gave another interview in his hotel room in Los Angeles there. And this time, he had a criminal defense attorney present. And it was during this interview where he basically downplayed this, quote, beef between he and Robert Wagner. And where he said he was asleep. This was the beginning of the I was asleep narrative. After that, Christopher Walken didn't say anything for a couple of years until he was interviewed by a British magazine called The Face Magazine, F-A-C-E. And I think people can find this on the internet. But he was interviewed by The Face Magazine, and he was interviewed by a very prominent and reliable reporter. And they took pictures of him and so forth. And he was asked about all this. And that's when he said he was asleep when it happened. And the reporter ended the interview by saying, "The perfect alibi." So he's maintained that. He gave an interview to Playboy magazine. He gave an interview to, I think it was the Star tabloid. And in those interviews, he talked about being asleep when it happened. Yes, sir.
Just for my audience that might not know this, Playboy magazine, despite what we know it as the Playboy that we know today, actually did some really good reporting back in the day. They had interviewed Castro. They had interviewed big historical figures and had some actual really good articles where we get the stereotype, oh, I buy Playboy for the reading. It's like, well, there is some truth to that. They did post some really, really good interviews and articles.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up. Because you make a very, very good point. The magazine, when it first started, it wasn't anything like the magazine that it became. And the reason why I think Playboy magazine became kind of, you know, sleazy kind of like, was that's it, dollars. And also they were in competition with Hustler, magazine. And Hustler magazine started off sleazy and continued that way. But you're exactly right. When that magazine first started, Howard Hughes, I mean, he had an empire. And while his magazine did include sexual things, even the photo spreads were not, they weren't sleazy looking. These were beautiful women, and they showed them, and not only with their clothes off, they showed them doing their hobbies and at work or whatever, or places they'd been. And then they had articles. And you're right, they actually interviewed Fidel Castro. So they had some significant articles. And one of these big articles that they had was with Christopher Walken. And I believe the article was done, I'm guessing now, but I believe the article was done about mid-80s. So within a few years of Natalie's death, they had this article with Christopher Walken. And the reason why Christopher Walken makes my blood boil is Christopher Walken's stateroom was about 25 feet from the master stateroom in this yacht. Now, there is an abundance of circumstantial evidence that corroborates the boat captain's story about there being this big fight in the master stateroom and onto the deck, a back deck. There is no possible way that Christopher Walken, who went to his room shortly before this fight started, could not have heard this cussing, screaming, banging fight. There's just no possible way. I also discovered two witnesses that are still alive today that testified when they went to the yacht when they were doing the search for Natalie. Because the official search for Natalie started at about 1 o'clock in the morning and didn't end until 7:44 when her body was found. So they were searching out there for over 7 hours. But during that time, these two witnesses went to the yacht and they saw Christopher Walken there, along with the boat captain, and he was awake. He wasn't asleep. So he heard what was going on, and he had an opportunity to do something about it, and he didn't.
Why do you think he lied? Do you think he
his
was
career?
Do you think he was
it
covering?
It was all about his career.
That's okay.
He wanted to protect his career at all costs. His career meant more to him than his honesty. It meant more to him than doing the right thing. It was the number one thing in his life, his career.
I'm never watching another Christopher Walken movie again, I can tell you that much. My generation's only known him as an actor that they grew up watching him in like films or something. We don't really know the whole Natalie Wood thing, but you know, I was a fan, but not anymore.
Well, listen, I want everybody to know something. And I'm not just trying to sell books, because I said from the very beginning that all my author's profits were going to charity in Natalie's memory. And that's exactly where the money that I've received from selling books has gone. But if you read my book, you will see even more than what I told you about Christopher Walken and about what he could have done, in my opinion, to stop what ended up happening. And that was a fight between Wagner and Natalie Wood on the back deck that ended up with her in the ocean.
Now, do you believe it was a fight that got out of hand, or do you believe that it was something like accidental, or do you think that it was intended, like this was the final straw? I mean, is there any scenarios or instances that he's hit her before and it's been told to the public, or it's been at least hinted at towards the public, that would give more evidence or motive to being like, yeah, this is he 100% hit her again.
Right, right. Yeah, we'll talk about the motive evidence in a minute, but you asked some great questions, Robbie, and let me say this about what you asked about the last straw. The four of them went to Catalina Island, and Friday night, they moored in Avalon. And Avalon is the biggest, by the way, it's a beautiful spot. If anybody wants a great vacation, you need to go to Catalina Island for a long weekend because it's a terrific place. But they went to Avalon and they moored the boat. Well, that evening, after they had been shopping on shore, that evening, there was a Christopher Walken described it as a, quote, hubbub. I love this guy and his vocabulary when it comes to stuff like this. But what happened was Robert Wagner had become, and this is historical and verified even out of his own mouth, he had become very jealous of Natalie Wood's co-stars. Every time Natalie Wood got involved in a movie, he was always the suspicious that she was having an affair with a co-star. And that had happened in a TV movie that Natalie did in 1979, a movie called From Here to Eternity. I don't know if that title strikes you or not, but there was a very, very famous movie that was done called From Here to Eternity that starred Burt Lancaster. And they did a movie, a TV movie of it, and Natalie Wood played the leading female star. By the way, she won a Golden Globe for that performance, by the way. But during that movie, her co-star was William Devane. And there was, and Wagner was over in Hawaii while they were shooting. There was this big blow up while they were shooting this movie between Natalie and Wagner, over Wagner accusing Natalie of having an affair with Devane. And no evidence, of course, of this, but this was Wagner, okay? So now let's go back to 1981. We got Christopher Walken in the boat. Well, he's co-starring with Natalie in a movie called Brainstorm, which, by the way, is the title of my book. He's starring with Natalie in this movie and another lovely lady by the name of Louise Fletcher, who was an Academy Award winner too. So they were on location shooting in North Carolina, and then they came back to Los Angeles, and this was during Thanksgiving. And so this is when Walken got asked to go out on the yacht. So now we go to Friday night. And Friday night, there's this big blow up with Robert Wagner, who is in a jealous rage over Christopher Walken. So Christopher Walken runs down to his stateroom again, which he was very good at. And when that happened, Natalie was so upset with Robert Wagner that she got Dennis DeVern, and they got in the dinghy, and he took her to Avalon, where they checked into a hotel for the night. They got two rooms, but Natalie was afraid to stay by herself, so Dennis DeVern stayed in the room with her. Now, this is undisputed, by the way. This is not Sam Peroni, and this is not made up. While they were in the room together, Natalie was upset with how Wagner was acting. And she was telling the boat captain that his drinking was getting to him, and that she was sick and tired of him being so jealous of her co-stars, and that she was going to do something about it. Come Monday, she was going to go see her lawyer. Okay, so what that means right there is, at that moment, you know that Natalie Wood is upset enough about what Wagner's doing to actually separate from him and divorce him a second time. For those of you who might be interested, Natalie married Wagner the first time in 1957. And a few years later, she caught him having an affair with not a woman, but a man. And this was back at a time when that was more than taboo. So Natalie divorced him, I mean, immediately. And so they go along, and then back in 1972, they get married again. Now, that's a long story, too, but they get married for the second time. And so now here's Natalie talking to Dennis DeVern, the boat captain, about going to see her lawyer. And I'm confident that she was like going to see him for maybe the purpose of filing a divorce action against Wagner, because she was tired of messing with him. But the next morning, instead of leaving the island, which she wanted to do, they couldn't find transportation for her. So she decided to go back to the yacht. And when she went back to the yacht, they moved the boat from Avalon to a desolate place called the Isthmus. Catalina Island is shaped almost like an hourglass laying on its side. And there's a narrow little spot kind of in the middle, and it's called the Isthmus. And people like to go there because it's very secluded at the time, and it still is, I think. There was only one restaurant bar in the Isthmus. There were no hotels. There was a little store that people that lived there could buy a few things in, but it was desolate. And the move was occasioned by Mr. Wagner. He's the one that wanted to move the boat. Right? And that's what the fight was about Friday night, because he wanted to move the boat in the middle of the night. And Natalie got so mad at him that she left the yacht. So that's how we lead up to Saturday night. Now, what happened before the big fight in the master stateroom? And by the way, this has been admitted to by Robert Wagner in his book called Pieces of My Heart. And Dennis Davern, of course, has confirmed this. He's the first one that came out with it. But after they had dinner Saturday night, they went back to the yacht. And within minutes of getting back to the yacht, Wagner got upset with something that Christopher Walken said. And he picked a wine bottle up, pulled it back over his shoulder by the neck of the bottle, and smashed it on the edge of a coffee table in the yacht, with wine and glass flying all over the place. Well, needless to say, Natalie didn't take to that very well. Christopher Walken, after going outside for a minute or two, came back and went down to his stateroom, which he was good at doing. And Natalie, by that time, had told Wagner that what he did was just beyond any awful description. She turned around and went down to the master stateroom. Well, after Walken went to his stateroom and Natalie went to her stateroom, Wagner told the boat captain, "I'm going to go down and see if I can't patch this up." And when he went down there, things didn't get patched up. I don't know what was said, because Dennis DeBurn said he couldn't hear what they were saying. All he could hear were some cuss words now and then. But there's no telling what was discussed, including Natalie Wood saying, you know what, I'm going to go see a lawyer come Monday, and we're just going to call this quits. I mean, she could have said that based on what she told DeVern Friday night. So to answer, that's a long answer to your question. But to answer your question, there was this fight up in the master salon, in the salon, where Wagner busts the wine bottle over the table. Then Natalie turns around and goes downstairs to the master stateroom. And a few minutes later, Wagner follows her down there. They have this big fight. And then all of a sudden it gets quiet. And the boat captain comes down to see what's going on. And Natalie's gone.
I just got two final questions for you, because you've given me enough of your time, and I want people to be able to read your book as well, too, and the extensive work that you have done. My first question is, out of all the people that have come to their own theories or ideas or have done their own research that don't have the background that you do, have they come kind of close or similar, maybe not as much in depth as you? But they've come kind of close to the point or close to the mark, or maybe as far as, or maybe a little bit before, a few steps before where you've gotten?
No, they haven't come close. And the reason why they haven't come close is they spend all their time trying to figure out, which you cannot do, how Natalie actually got into the water. A lot of them have contended that Natalie Wood was hit over the head and thrown overboard by Robert Wagner. But there was absolutely no forensic evidence to support that. And as a matter of fact, during press conferences back in 1981, both the coroner, Thomas Noguchi, who ended up writing a book, and he said the same thing, and his chief administrative assistant said that Natalie Wood was conscious when she hit the water. There was no evidence she was unconscious. So anybody that's out there saying that Natalie Wood was hit over the head and thrown overboard is completely, totally wrong, number one. And number two, there's absolutely no evidence to support it, none. The second thing is that they want to try to prove that Robert Wagner pushed her over the side. Well, he could have. But unless Robert Wagner confessed to it, there would be absolutely no way to prove it. Here's what I believe happened, and it's in my book. What I believed happened was the swim step door was always open unless the children were on the yacht. Well, the children weren't on the yacht. So the likelihood is the swim step door was open. DeVern said that during this argument, at one point he heard Wagner or Natalie, one of them, say, no, it was Wagner, get off my fucking yacht. But what I believe happened was this. During this argument, Robert Wagner grabbed Natalie by the throat. And when he did, he left a thumbnail impression in the midline of her throat. And he pushed her towards the swim step, like, get off my boat. And when he did, Natalie slipped and she hit her knee, which was a big bruise on her left knee, and hit her ankle as she tumbled through the swim step door into the water. Now, here's where the murder occurred. The murder occurred because Natalie was awake and Natalie was screaming for help. And two people on the yacht closest to them, they were on a sailboat, they heard the screams. They heard a lady screaming in the water for help just about the time Natalie Wood would have ended up in the water, around between 11 o'clock and midnight. But they couldn't tell where the person was. And then they heard a man say, "Well, hold on, we're coming to get you." And then shortly thereafter, it got quiet and they just assumed the guy went and got her. They couldn't jump in and get her. The water was cold. They couldn't see anything. I mean, there was no way they could do that. But in my book, one of the people talked to me. Her name is Marilyn Wayne. And she is a very, very credible person. And she told me about hearing these screams. She and her little son, who was 8, and her boyfriend, who was there, who was a very prominent businessman in town. And she worked for an investment brokerage firm. I mean, these were credible, honorable people. And the sheriff's department just ignored them back then at the time. So that's what, if people ask me, that's what I think happened. I think she fell through the swim step door, and then Wagner didn't go get her. And when he didn't go get her, that was second degree murder.
What are you hoping that your book and anything that we can do from either a younger generation standpoint or just anyone that would be interested in seeking truth? I mean, is there still time to get the record change and get some redemption for Natalie Wood?
You know, there is something people can do. First of all, I don't want you to take my word for all this. I'd like for you to read the book. I've got evidence in there, photographs, all sorts of things that you can see. I don't ask you to just rely on my word. And I never did. When I was a prosecutor, I couldn't do that. I was doing it for a jury. But I have a petition on change.org where I have been asking the coroner's office to conduct a public inquest into Natalie Wood's death. It's too late to prosecute Robert Wagner. First of all, I don't know that he's competent enough to stand trial. And secondly, too many witnesses, important witnesses, have died and evidence has been lost. So you couldn't go to a criminal court and prove anybody guilty of murder. But there's no statute of limitations on an inquest. And the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office could conduct a public inquest. And I've been writing and writing and writing to not only the coroner, but the DA in Los Angeles and the sheriff in Los Angeles, because both the DA and the sheriff can, with a simple pen, one sentence under the law, request that the coroner conduct an inquest. And so people can go and they can sign my petition, which I continuously supply to them. And if they get a chance, they can tell the DA that he needs to ask the coroner to conduct an inquest.
And is there a place where people can find any of your links to your book, your website?
Right. Yes. The website is www.NatalieWoodBrainstorm.com. And of course, if you just go to Amazon, you'll find me there in the book, and you find a paperback on my website. Trying to think of other places. Barnes and Noble, you can go there and you could order my book. Kindle, I believe it's on audiobook. I know it's on an audiobook. So you can get it and listen to it in your car if you want to. All those things would help me. Let me conclude, if you have time, let me conclude with this. This may make me sound like a conspiracy theorist, which I can tell you I am not, but I have had a very, very difficult time getting the mainstream media to address what I have found in my book, including the motive evidence, which we really didn't discuss, but it's in there. Lots of motive evidence that I found that nobody else has found, nobody else has dealt with but me. But I have had a very difficult time getting the truth out there. It's kind of like everybody says we want the truth, but when it comes down to the truth, they don't want to hear about it. They'd like to spend more of their time on suspects and a mystery rather than evidence. People can help me get the word out there that there's a book where people can see what happened, which would support a public inquest by the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office. And in that inquest, what could happen is a jury or a panel of forensic pathologists can find one of two things. It was an accident, or it was at the hands of another, which means homicide. And we could clear this up. Natalie Wood's death certificate could finally say something other than undetermined. The truth would be out there. But I have fought for years trying to get the truth out there. And I just can't get the mainstream media. They won't even tell me why they won't publish it. They just won't. Maybe it's because Robert Wagner is still alive. I don't know. Or Christopher Walken might get embarrassed. Or the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department might get embarrassed. Or the Los Angeles County Coroner's Office might get embarrassed.
I think it's probably the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department and all that. That seems a little bit more plausible. But Sam, I'm going to have you on for a part two. You just got to give me some time to listen to your book on audiobook. I'm glad it's like that because that's how I like to listen to my books. But I'm going to link all your links in the description, Sam. I appreciate all the work you have done in this case and being able to give me the time to listen and understand the case as well, too, as much as anybody out there listening, maybe for the first time, has never really heard this story before.
You know, Robbie, I sincerely appreciate this. I really do. And if you and your listeners want me to come back for episode two, I'll be happy to. And we could talk about motive evidence and anything else that you think people might be interested in.
Well, thank you again, Sam. And thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode of Out of the Blank. Stay tuned for next episode.